from Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much. And for the first time ever on the Richie Allen Radio Show, we'll have the sports news as reported on the newspaper review show this morning on YouTube. The far right were in meltdown over the last couple of days when they learned that a young Muslim woman would be riding a horse at Glorious Goodwood today wearing a hijab. Well, she only went in one, you know.
What kind of fuckery is this?
She only went in one, the race. God love her, Khadija Mella, the first hijab-wearing jockey ever, wins at Glorious Goodwood today. And that's the sport, children. That's the sport. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show, by the way.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Oh, they were in meltdown. How could we allow a woman wear a hijab on a horse at an English horse race? Well, she went and won the race. Well done, Khadija. Right, coming up on the programme this hour, the wonderful Pippa King, the privacy campaigner, biometrics in schools. Pippa's been campaigning against intrusions to children's privacy in education, but much more besides. She joins the programme to talk about facial recognition software, 5G and more. Great lady, Pippa King, on the programme. And in the second hour, the former ITV and BBC journalist Anna Breese returns to the programme. Check out breesemedia.co.uk. We'll talk about a lot around the reporting of the Carl Beach case, but we'll also talk about Anna's wonderful mission to empower people to become their own journalists and to make citizen journalism a reality using their phones and their tablets. Wonderful lady, two brilliant women on the programme today. It's Thursday's Richie Allen Show, live on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv. How you doing? You well, Khadija? Khadija won the jockey. Yeah, bit of fun there. Fair play to her. Fair play to her. Right, let's just leave that one alone and move right on. Before I get myself into trouble. Oh, it's all doom and gloom. Oh, dear listener. It's all doom and gloom. All day long. Well, it's not just all day today. It's all day every day. It's all doom and gloom in the mainstream media. And the doom and gloom surrounds Brexit. It surrounds Brexit, and it surrounds what's going to happen if we leave with no deal. Now, before the referendum itself back in 2016, there were a lot of scare stories designed to convince people to vote Remain. In the last few days, the days since Boris Johnson has won the Conservative leadership contest, thus making him the Prime Minister, people believe that Johnson is heading towards a no-deal Brexit. I don't believe it for a minute, but anyway, people believe that. So the scare stories have replicated. They're like gremlins or mogwais with water being poured on them. They're multiplying these stories. I'm going to give you a flavour of about five or six headlines. These are genuine headlines from the last few days, dear listener. Sure, you won't believe it. You ready? You ready? These are genuine headlines now. If we leave with no deal. Nancy. Bank of England slashes growth forecast amid no-deal Brexit fear. The pound is getting slammed. More bad news for Britain. UK car investment slumps 70% on no-deal Brexit fears. We'll be laying off the car manufacturing workers. Diabetics have been hoarding their insulin on no-deal Brexit fears. The UK and the EU is headed for a Cold War standoff over no-deal Brexit. Yeah. The French admit they could block UK exports in event of no-deal Brexit. Ah. Ah! No deal will kill us all. And then Irish PM says everyone in Ireland should be afraid of a no-deal Brexit. And finally, house builders voice fears over standard of new homes after Brexit uncertainty sees construction firms lay off staff. We're all going to die. Do you want to hear the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney? You don't. Tough titties. You're going to hear him anyway. Here he is today. He was asked by the media, what does this no Brexit, what does it imply for the ordinary, excuse me, no deal? What does it imply for the ordinary man and woman?
Well, let me reiterate that, again, we obviously don't speak for the government, but we listen to the government in terms of their stated policies, and it's still the stated aim of the government to have a deal. First point. But in terms of preparations, it is important to reinforce to people on the street, hopefully people also have homes to go to, but people on the street, that the financial system is ready for it. We have been preparing for this for years, you know, both in terms of what we can do, but also the institutions themselves. But a no-deal situation, broad brush, is one in which sterling is likely to be lower, in which inflation is likely to be higher for a period of time, and the economy is likely to slow.
Yeah, don't panic. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Vaccines. Sky News is running one of these campaigns that I've been talking about. They've run campaigns on plastic in the oceans. Maybe no bad thing. They're running this big campaign on climate change. They're now running a campaign on vaccines. This is serious. This is an organisation that purports to present you with a series of facts. It isn't, obviously, but that's what it purports to do. Sky News claims that it has exclusive analysis of data from international agencies, from the Global Burden of Disease study, from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation. Sky News has got their own people to look at a series of data, and they have concluded it is shocking. We need to be taking more vaccines. We're not taking enough. And 7,000 people are dying needlessly every day around the world because they haven't had their vaccine. Here's Professor Helen Stokes Lampard, nothing to Frank Lampard, the Chelsea manager. She's from the Royal College of GPs. Professor Helen Stokes Lampard went on Sly News this morning, and here she is.
Yes, globally, the uptake of vaccination is improving steadily, which is excellent and absolutely as it should be. What's worrying, however, is that in Western countries where uptake had been very good, it's declining. And that's what really concerns me. You know, in the part of the world where we are most affluent and most able to provide vaccinations for absolutely everyone who needs them, people are choosing not to take up this opportunity. That's a cause for concern, and it's something we absolutely need to call out, to highlight and do all that we can to push back against to ensure that every child is vaccinated, is protected for life.
Every child.
Is there any credence to these anti-vax campaigns that do make the headlines? I mean, certainly it's been in the United States, there's been some quite high profile ones recently.
Robert Kennedy Jr., why don't you call him out by his name?
Do they carry any credence at all?
No credence whatsoever.
What?
The scientific community is appalled by what's going on. We have a generation of fake news, a generation of misinformation, and the problem is it's confusing to the public.
Because the public are stupid, right?
Scientists, healthcare professionals the world over are absolutely unanimous in this. Vaccination is safe, is effective, and every child, every person who could benefit must be offered it.
Are they the descendants of the same scientists who told us that smoking cigarettes was okay? I'm just wondering.
So we all have a responsibility here to call out the nonsense.
Call out the nonsense. I'm in the final now.
Of course, everybody who cares for their child wants the very best for them. But if you want the best for your child, listen to those who have no vested interest. Listen to those whose job it is to put heart and soul into delivering the best for your child.
Right, let's park the no vested interest for a minute. Park it to the side there. Just keep your eye on it. We'll come back to it in a minute. Lies. Safe for everyone. Safe for everyone, she says. Well, she must be aware of the UK Sunday Independent story of May 31st, 2015. Thousands of girls report feeling seriously ill after routine school vaccination. That was about Gardasil, and that was in the UK. Thousands. Thousands. They're totally safe. Totally. 100%. Nothing wrong with them. Thousands of girls seriously ill, routine school vaccination. So she's, as Jimmy Nail said once or sang once, she's lying. So we know that it's not proven that they're safe. Park the vested interest thing because that's very funny and very timely. What else did this professor say?
There's still got to be a level of education, hasn't there, in these areas where people are having questions about these vaccines. I mean, how do you provide convincing information that they are going to take on and believe?
Well, we need a multifaceted approach. I mean, we need to educate through the healthcare system. Of course we do. And as a GP, that's one of my jobs, on a one-to-one basis, when people come in asking questions about, should I have my child vaccinated? Should I be vaccinated?
The answer is yes. Yes. GPs just need to say, yes, of course, yes. Should I be vaccinated? Yes, of course you should be.
We can have that one-to-one advice. But this is a wider message. So public health messaging, so Public Health England and the public health domains around the four nations of the UK have a role here.
Social media.
The chief medical officer is doing a huge amount of work on this.
Social media.
But there is something about the social media outlets too. Where are the responsible social media users who can call out the nonsense when they see them? The companies who run social media have a responsibility to appreciate the huge harm that their organisations are peddling, are allowing to be manifest. And individuals, if you see nonsense on social,
if you see nonsense on social media,
your friends and colleagues are spreading scare stories, don't be afraid to...
Did she used to be on Heidi High one time?
To call them out. Just signpost people to the NHS website.
I go to the NHS Wedford because... There's no vested interest. Wait till you hear this.
NHS.uk, wonderful source of clear, honest, trustworthy information. It's not sponsored by any companies. That nobody's got a vested interest. The only interest that the NHS has is in keeping you and your family safe.
She's lying. I don't love nobody else. She's lying. You can trust the NHS. No vested interest, no sponsors of this information. She's got a very short memory. Very short memory. May 23rd this year, May 23rd. Was the future Mrs. Allen's birthday. I remembered well, and I remember covering this story well. Listen carefully now, children. This is only 6 weeks, 7, 8, 9 weeks ago. Big Pharma poured £57 million into UK patient charities, which could influence NHS drug decision makers, report finds. Did you hear that? Let me explain it. Let me break it down. Drug firms are shaping the profiles of patient organisations through heavy investment. So patients, people who use the NHS, have their own lobby groups. And they're serious lobby groups, patients, right? Who have these lobby groups to lobby the NHS. And drugs firms have been donating massive amounts of money to them. Right? Meaning that they are influencing what those patient organisations are demanding of the National Health Service. If you can't climb the mountain, go around it. £57 million quid into UK patient groups who research and lobby for new treatments into specific conditions. This is the same thing as bribing doctors, which, of course, we know went on for decades because GlaxoSmithKline and others were fined billions of dollars in the US and elsewhere and in China for bribing doctors to prescribe their medicine. Now, they can't do that anymore without being caught. So now they're using lobby groups to get what they want. So the professor from the Royal College of GPs, well, she's a pathological lawyer because she will know this. Bath University, all credit to them. May the road rise with Bath University because they discovered this. It's been going on for years and the amount of money being donated has doubled and trebled in the last 3-4 years. Wait for it. Half of the funding was primarily earmarked for research or campaigning activities. Campaigning, just like the campaigning we've heard Sky News do today. And the doctor who wants you to believe that she's not representing any vested interest group. She's lying. I don't want nobody else. I tell you, she's lying. Liars. This is how they've gotten around the massive fines for bribing doctors. And you heard it first, and you heard it exclusively on the Richie Allen Radio Show. This is why we exist. No such thing as entirely independent groups or bodies. The NHS is far from independent. Okay, right, let's move on. 17 minutes past the hour, 6 minutes time, Pippa King will be on the programme. Can't wait to catch up with Pippa. Wait for this. A record number of anti-Semitic incidents has been recorded in the UK for the first 6 months of this year by the Community Security Trust. Remember the name, Community Security Trust. There were 892 reported incidents between January and June, 10% increase on last year, which also had a record high, said the Community Security Trust. Remember the name. It is a charity that monitors anti-Semitism and provides security for the British Jewish community. They're a bunch of thugs masquerading as a charity. I'll tell you more about them in a minute. Thugs, right? So what's going on? Let's listen to Sky News presenter Neil Patterson. He introduces the story this morning.
Now, a report by a leading Jewish charity has detailed a record high of anti-Semitic incidents in the United Kingdom in the first 6 months of 2019. Let's just have a look at the details of all of this. The Community Security Trust report found that there were 892 anti-Semitic hate incidents between January and June this year. Now, that represents a 10% increase from the same period last year. Marie van der Zyl is the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews and joins me now. Marie, thank you very much for being with
us. Good morning. Yeah.
There has been an awful lot of discussion of anti-Semitism over the past couple of years here in the United Kingdom. You know, people suggesting that criticism of Israel can be, can't be. But let's be clear about the incidents that have been identified here. These are absolutely disgusting, abhorrent,
what?
Clear-cut incidences of anti-Semitism.
Are you asking her or are you telling her? What sort of a presenter are you, you arsehole? That's Neil Patterson. Anyway, let's hear the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, Marie van der Zyl. What's going on, Marie?
There has been an increase year on year, and I think there is a direct link between anti-Semitism and the Labour Party, which is being fuelled more widely into society.
Right. At this point, he has to jump in. So, Corbyn came along, more anti-Semitism. Now it's being fueled into society. Where, how are we seeing that? Crimes against people, against Jewish people, are they on the rise? Has something happened recently? That's the presenter's job, right? Of course he doesn't do it.
I mean, Mr. Corbyn would suggest that certainly he is not an anti-Semite, that he has campaigned against racism.
We know all that. He should have asked her about the societal issue. Where's the evidence that there are attacks against Jews?
In all its forms. What is your issue with the way in which the Labour Party is policing itself at the moment? And
yeah, let's not hear any of that. It just rambles on, and she goes on about one incident where somebody says that they're losing sympathy with Jews, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But some guy in the Labour Party recently said, very recently said, that he's losing sympathy with Jews. She thinks that's hate speech. It isn't, of course. And she can't understand why he hasn't been fired. So then Patterson asks her a question.
How are British Jews responding to these sorts of activities? I mean, frankly, you drive through North London, you pass schools, Jewish schools, and you will notice on every one of them there is an armed security guard on the front doorstep.
Yes, provided by the Community Security Trust. Remember that, this charity. I've got armed guards on the synagogues and on the schools, right? Think about that. I'll come back to it in a minute. So what are Jews thinking of it then? Well, what would you expect them to think?
There is real concern. And if you look...
Of course there is.
...look into the report, you will see the rise in the number of assaults. It is very sad that any community has to have police. Or the fact, we're very lucky we have the CST, but it's an increasingly... concern for everybody in the country to have to live under those conditions, to have guards outside schools and on the streets.
In your role as president of the Board of Deputies, do you see any future relationship between British Jewry and the Labour Party?
British Jewry.
The Board of Deputies has recently told the Labour Party what steps it needs to take to...
Yeah, piss off, love. Right, so that was the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The community, this group, by the way, the CST, right, which we heard about, the Community Security Trust, the CST, is a charity. But it's a charity that is funded by the British government. And it uses that money, lots of it, by the way, to put hired goons on the doors of schools and synagogues to terrorise. To terrorise and terrify young Jewish children who don't deserve it. To convince them that there's some apocalyptic battle going on outside the gates, that you, as a Jewish child and a Jewish family, you're in terrible danger because everybody hates you. They've got a vested interest, this charity, in terrifying Jews and convincing them of a rise in Jew hatred. There's little transparency. There's no accountability of this CST group whatsoever. And nobody has challenged them to provide some of the examples of this 892 hate incidents that have happened this year. Nobody has said, give us an example so we can analyse the claims and we can decide for ourselves if Jews are in any danger. And if you want to read about this CST group, these charities, this goonish charity, Read Tony Greenstein online. He's a Jewish man based in London who's an anti-Zionist, and he's been writing about them. This is very serious stuff, folks. It really is. Pippa King joins me in a minute. This is the Richie Allen Show for Thursday, August 1st, 2019. And I'm Richie Allen. And this is music from Bruce the Boss Springsteen. Welcome to your Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, the TuneIn app, and my website as well. Welcome! Bruce Springsteen on the Richie Allen Show, Badlands. It's 26 minutes past the hour, Thursday's programme. Thanks for the tweets thus far. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Let's introduce my guest this hour. She's no stranger to you. Loads of stories. I mean, loads. This week, the city of Cambridge in Massachusetts, which I visited once, and it's a lovely place, has moved closer to basically prevent the local government from using facial recognition technology. Three other cities in the country have already instituted such bans. That's in the United States, because of concerns that the technology is biased and that it violates basic human rights. Last December, Cambridge City Council passed the Surveillance Technology Ordinance, which requires the council's approval prior to the acquisition or deployment of certain surveillance tech, which included facial recognition software. Now, listeners to this programme will remember we covered earlier this month the findings of Essex University, which showed that the UK Met Police facial recognition trials were deeply flawed, and that just 8 correct matches were made out of 42, suggested despite this, the Home Secretary then, he's the Chancellor now, but he was the Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, said that he would back the introduction of these police trials more widely of this facial recognition camera technology. And in the Financial Times today, there are stories about how London will be a test case, or has been a test case, for using facial recognition in local authorities, but also in bars. So bar staff know just who is next in line for a beer. This is no joke. And like I said, there's very little I can tell you about my guest, because you know all about her. She's blazed the trail, I think, over the years in demonstrating to people how you can take action yourself, individually, against this sort of thing, campaigning against the introduction of this technology in her own children's school. She's written biometrics in schools and against RFID in schools, the blogs, of course. She's been campaigning for about 15 years on these issues. I will put links to where you can find more about her online. Let's welcome back Pippa King to the programme. How are you, Pippa?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's great to have you on, because you're the authority on this. Everywhere you look, there's a story rolling it out in bars. Thanks for the information you sent me today. I want to get into that in a minute, the specific incidences and stories that you're covering. But the Essex University was obviously, the report was very welcome. It was brilliant. And yet the Home Secretary at the time said, well, yeah, okay, but we're going to do it anyway. What's going on, Pippa?
Well, it was interesting because the police sort of championed themselves as saying, you know, we've got a very independent body that's going to look at us and look at the way we use facial recognition. And I think they thought that Essex University were going to come back with a glowing review. And in fact, it did the absolute opposite and said basically it's not fit for purpose. But essentially what the police are doing is they are using the NEC Japanese facial recognition system. They've not actually bought it. It's a proof of concept. So what I think, and this hasn't ever been said, but obviously why would the Japanese company give the police this facial recognition technology, is that they're basically letting it learn on the population of England and Wales.
Wow.
And I actually went in 2017 to, we were invited very reluctantly, but Liberty put some pressure on the police, Metropolitan Police, and about 7 of us were invited behind the scenes to the police using it at Notting Hill Festival, which is primarily people with darker skin. And with people with darker skin, because the facial features aren't as defined as lighter skinned people, the algorithms aren't very effective. So again, it just smacked of the company. I say, well, let's use it at this particular festival so we can refine the algorithm. I don't think the technology is at all robust enough to stand up in a court of law. And so what the police are using it for is, certainly the company is using it to try and refine the algorithms, I'm sure.
But this is groundbreaking. This is groundbreaking stuff. Now, you're saying this is all going belly up. It looks like it's bad for the tech companies. It looks like it's bad for the police. But because artificial intelligence is behind the analysis of the footage that is shot or taken, you reckon, Pippa, and you know what, I think you're onto something here, that they're just letting it go so that it can learn, it can get better, basically of its own volition, basically.
Yeah, and I also think as well that people are sort of saying, well, it's not very good tech, so we should be banning it. Actually, if it was fantastic tech, would that make it okay to implement?
No.
It's not the accuracy of the tech. Well, it is, you know, there's a part of an argument there, but it's actually, if it was amazing technology, would we want it anyway? And that whole discussion hasn't been happened. Brexit is taking up a huge amount of time in Parliament, and I had a couple of debates that we've had parliamentary time tabled for that hasn't happened because something else has happened to do with Brexit. So it's this issue is just being kicked into long grass, and in the meantime, MPs have told the police and told the Home Office, let's just stop using it until we've had that important discussion. And the Home Office, like you just said no. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. I mean, they're like kids in a candy shop. The thing that worries me about it is that police can potentially use it for an information phishing expedition. So, for example, last November, they used it at the Cenotaph November the 11th event. And they were looking for people that weren't necessarily wanted because they'd skipped arrest warrants or something like that. They were looking for people that might create a crime. So people that might have been a bit abusive on Twitter to maybe some of the royal family. And so there was a whole host of photographs on there of innocent people that they were sort of looking for. And this is the problem, because Mike Barton, who was the head of Durham Police, has overseen this whole facial recognition strategy by the Home Office and the police. And he's also overseen the huge 23 million face National Police database that has static facial recognition on, which is where you can take a photograph and say to the database, is there a match in there, rather than somebody leafing through thousands of images. Now, he started in Durham to build portfolios and files of innocent people, persons of interest, that they were taking photographs from body cams that actually shouldn't be recording. You know, there's specific instances and very clear definitions of when a body cam should record, and that's as it should be. But they were just randomly recording people who they thought might be of interest, and then they built this database up of persons of interest. And
why haven't they been pulled up on that, Pippa?
This well, is they again, have. The Information have Commissioner had instructed the police force to sort of delete the database, and as far as I know, the police force just said no.
They've said no, but it should go beyond that, because I do remember reading they were instructed to wipe the data. I remember reading that. I probably read it on your website. I'm pretty sure I did. But what good is that unless you look? I don't want to see people fired, unless you punish people for doing it.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I've not gone back and had a look at that story. This was in May 2017, and certainly the initial reaction from Durham Police was, no, we're not going to destroy the data. Bearing in mind that the guy that sort of said that is the guy that's been overseeing the whole of the facial recognition sort of program with the Home Office. So it gives you an essence of the type of morals that's been put behind the whole project.
And it's scary too. It's scary too. Didn't I read, and again, you might have been talking about it, didn't a teacher or some professional walking past a van or a police car or a police lorry that was using one of these cameras, didn't he try to cover his features? And wasn't he threatened by the police? This was a recent story, wasn't it, if I remember?
Yeah, it was this winter, I think it might have been January, at the Stratford Centre, shopping centre in London. And Big Brother Watch had been out and were handing leaflets out and making people aware that the unmarked van was there, and the guy decided to pull up his jumper and pull down his cap, and the police, on that basis, because he hid his face, stopped him. And then there was a bit of a sort of exchange of words, and this man basically told the police to F off, and that's what he got the £90 fine for. So he got a public order fine for telling the police to F off, basically, which I think he was well within his rights to, because they were stopping and saying, why can't we see your face? I mean, because you're allowed to walk around with your face covered
up. Without being spied on and followed by people.
Yeah.
This is Pippa, this is massive, this. Do you know it is? And again, I think I often say this. It doesn't get enough coverage, this. This is huge. And because it doesn't get enough coverage, it just seems to just trickle on, doesn't it? And it just moves on.
It does, because essentially the street furniture is the same. I mean, really, we're looking, or I'm looking, along with the sort of privacy organisations, responsible use of the tech by government departments. And we have the Freedom of Information Act, where we can start to ask government departments and police forces how they're handling the data and how they're using the technology. But as you said earlier on, private companies and shopping centres are starting to jump on the same bandwagon. So I don't know if you remember about 20, 30 years ago, we used to walk in a pub and behind the bar there'd be some grainy photos of people that were banned from the pub. And that equivalent, that company was called FaceWatch. And that company is now supplying pubs with CCTV with built-in facial recognition behind them. So they have a list of sort of people that have got ASBOs or, you know, are on a watch list and or have been, you know, naughty around pubs, yeah. I don't know. But what they're starting to do now is combine that information with the police. So you've got this blurring of
roles. That's outrageous, that, isn't it? I mean, you have the right, Pippa King and your fella, and I've got the right with my missus, to go out tonight to Deansgate and to go into a pub and to expect that I am not being watched by the state vicariously through the cooperation of the bloody pub. I mean, that's beyond Orwellian, isn't it? And yet it's happening.
It's not just happening in pubs, it's happening in everywhere. Supermarkets and shopping cinemas. Centres. But we can't track the advent of that because these are private companies and are not subject to freedom of information. So there's a very big unknown commercial use of facial recognition in the public sector that is a largely unknown. I think the only person that probably would have some knowledge of it is the Surveillance Camera Commissioner, Tony Porter. He's a really good guy. He makes a lot of good noises, but his role is completely, he can't enforce any legislation, and whatever legislation there is not up to date with the technology.
Is he the watchdog, Pippa? Sorry to interrupt you. You mentioned this guy, Tony Porter. Is mm-hmm. he, these private companies that are not subject to freedom of information request, they don't have to comply with them because they're private companies. Does he have some authority over these companies?
He does, but it's a voluntary code of practice that he set up that's sort of loosely based around the small bits of legislation we've got covering CCTV. And so companies, you know, some big companies sign up to his code of practice, but which is great. There's one man, and I think maybe a couple of people in his office, they can't enforce that code of practice, and it's not a statutory code of practice anyway. So if companies sign up for it and break it, A, the Surveillance Cameras Commissioner's Office probably wouldn't know, and B, and even if they did know, what, you know, who's going to notice that a kite, not even a kite mark, or this voluntary sort of code of practice has been taken away? So it is a bit of a sort of free-for-all out there as far as this technology is going. But at the moment in the UK, we've only got live facial recognition system in mobile police units. We haven't got anything behind public space CCTV yet, except for Glasgow City Council.
Which I was going to come to. And just before we come to that, so at the moment it's mobile police vans in the UK, but presumably they'd love to get these things fixed in position on lampposts like they have the regular CCTV cameras. That's what they want.
Yeah, there was a grant that was issued to West Yorkshire Police a couple of years ago that actually they didn't spend, but the remit of that grant was to look at putting facial recognition behind public space CCTV and actually on public transport. So it would go on the rail system and the bus system so that it was completely ubiquitous. You know, so you couldn't hop on a bus and get rid of, you know, lose the trail. It was a complete sort of literally door to door. And they were sort of saying, well, of course, we're only going to use it for Alzheimer's patients and missing children.
Nonsense.
And we know that that's not the case because of the way that the Met Police has used their live facial recognition as a fishing expedition. And also as well, Glasgow have got their system set up behind 70 public space CCTV cameras. They haven't switched it on yet.
Let's talk about that now. Thanks for that information again today. You sent that. I give out several websites of yours. Which website do you want me to direct people to? Your own website?
So I have a biometrics in school website that simply deals with that. And again, I've got an RFID in schools which deals with sort of, we had this case where over 5,500 kids were tagged with live RFID tags a number of years ago in the UK. But then I have another website called stateofsurveillance.co.uk.
State of Surveillance, yeah.
And that's where I write about all the other bits of surveillance, millimetre microwave technologies, scanning you for weapons, facial recognition, revisiting the Glasgow thing, because I kept sending them freedom of information requests over the past 4 or 5 years since they've had the system, and I've always wanted the operational manual, sort of to say these are the circumstances in which you can follow and what it can do. And they've always said, well, we've not published it yet because, you know, it's too early a stage. And then the last freedom of information request I got back, they said, oh, we have published it, but we can't give it to you because it's national security and law enforcement, and we're going to hide behind that because that's an exemption under the Freedom of Information Act. So I went to the Scottish Information Commissioner's office, who oversees the Scottish Freedom of Information Act, and they basically said, cough up. So they did. So I now have the operational manual. And it does look like it's literally been put together on the back of a beer mat. And the Scottish Herald ran two articles on it, and the reporter there said to me, it does look as though they've literally cobbled it together. But it's interesting because I understood the system simply to be able to track people. So there's somebody in a blue coat and green trousers. And that sort of thing. They've always said it's not capable of facial recognition. Yes, it is, because it says in the manual, and it's give it a photograph and it'll find the person. There's no system that wouldn't be intelligent enough not to look at facial recognition. They might choose not to use that aspect of it, but all a system like that is doing is actually, it's not looking at faces or caps or glasses or beards, it's looking at pixels. And so what you're doing to the system is saying, this is a set of pixels in the form of a face or a hat or a bag. I want you to go and find the same set of pixels from all these, these security cameras. So the system it doesn't know what a face is, it's a computer system, but it just looks for the pixel. So you can put anything in there. But it's interesting because what we didn't know it could do is you can sort of geofence perimeters and sort of say, well, tell me if somebody steps over this line here. So it has intrusion detection. It knows whether people are loitering. I mean, who classes somebody loitering? Who knows what a bus stop? Is that loitering? I don't know. And if it's looking at crowd management, or you can get overcrowding alerts from it. And then the advanced, that was a standard video analytics. The advanced video analytics provides incident tracking. So if there was an antisocial behaviour or criminality event happening, then they could locate it via the cameras. But then they put in brackets, but we're not going to live track you or retrospective viewing. What are you doing with it then? Because you could always track somebody or use it for retrospective viewing. Anyway, what type of viewing are you doing with it?
This is the Glasgow suspect search person tracking system. I will share the link that Pippa sent to me today so you can read the little handbook, the operational manual, and you can see how vague it is. And it's crazy stuff. I'm fairly serious. I don't try and make light of anything. But I'm thinking of a future, like, maybe not exactly like, but we remember that excellent film, which appeared to be nothing when it came out, but it was very good. Sandra Bullock was in it, and Sylvester Stallone, Demolition Man. And you have everywhere in society, when somebody does something that's deemed to be an offence or in breach of something, a voice speaks up and tells them that they violated some code and that they're fined some credits or something like that. That has to be where it ends up, but that's not just silly, that's not just me trying to be silly. It must end up like that.
I mean, it's interesting. I know you've had people like Neil Sanders and Mark Devlin on before that talk about sort of this sort of boiling frog. These ideas in a couple of decades or in the generation before, and then it sort of slightly normalises it.
Yeah.
And you've got Minority Report, you've got
Minority Report.
And it is, people are more accepting of it. Who knows where it's going to go? It will go wherever we let it go, essentially. Yeah.
Do you know, you mentioned Minority Report. This is, I've not heard anybody say this. This is my own little fantasy. I do believe that in the very near future, this technology will be used to send somebody around to somebody's door to say to them, look, the AI, or they'll have some name for it, has been looking at you for quite a while. We're pretty certain that, whether you believe it or not, you're going to do something pretty nasty in the next couple of weeks. So we're just going to take you out of circulation just for a little while so we can have a chat with you. I really do believe that's coming. Maybe not in 5 years, but 20 years maybe.
The Home Office are running a program called the Data Driven Insights Program that West Midlands Police are looking at, and they are looking at exactly that. But they're not just looking at people who are going to be potential criminals, but they're looking at people who would be potential victims.
Potential criminals, potential victims. So that's a win-win for the state and for corporations who benefit from this, because if a victim needs to be helped out, well, there'll be some big private company that's formed a semi-state body with the government who will be happy to take a whack of cash to look after the victim temporarily. And the private prisons, we're privatising everything, as we know. The big private prison corporations will be only too thrilled to take Richie Allen, for example, or Pippa King in for a few weeks because, well, look, all the data says that you're going to offend against the state. This is no joke, Pippa. It scares the shit out of me, to be honest.
It's, and that's only what I know of and what's out in the public domain. I mean, the type of projects and developments that are going on behind the scenes in the security services and the military must be years ahead of what we're getting.
Years ahead. You remember Will Smith years ago when he made that film with Gene Hackman when he was on the run and he was being surveilled by the state? I can't remember what it was called. It began with a C. It might be Conspiracy or something. Will Smith and Gene Hackman. Smith gave an interview where he said that one of the big intelligence agencies was very helpful in giving some very sexy technology to the filmmakers. And Will Smith said, this is a true story. Smith said, oh, thanks for that. That's very good of you giving us this stuff. And it's really amazing. And the guy said exactly what you said, Pippa. The guy laughed at Smith, the spook, and he went, come on, kid. We're 25, 30 years ahead of this stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we've had face recognition that was trialled in schools in 2008, a long time ago, and it was turned off because it wasn't fit for purpose. And then we've got facial recognition sort of coming into society. But the reason why I've been looking at Glasgow is because the big ICT provider that was providing Glasgow City Council, Serco, their contract finished last year. And CGI, which is a huge Canadian multinational tech company, went in with a £399 million seven-year contract to do all the ICT in Glasgow. They also provide all the ICT systems for the Scottish Parliament, Edinburgh schools, hospitals, you name it, and the Scottish borders. So with this sort of new contract, CGI, which has just got contracting Scottish borders and Glasgow, have decided to gift an iPad to every single school child from the age of basically 5.
No way.
To 18. So, but the only reason I'm telling you that is because CGI coincidentally run the facial recognition system on the police national database.
Oh, you're shitting me. Can you repeat that again about the iPad? This company.
So CGI are issuing in total 63,000 iPads to school children in Glasgow and Scottish borders. So any child that's under 8, the ratio of iPad to child is 1 to 5. Any child 9 and above, every single child gets an iPad from CGI for free.
And the company got the contract to do what?
To supply all the ICT systems for the council, healthcare, schools, a big infrastructure ICT contract. Now, when CGI got the contract for Edinburgh, there was an article that ran a couple of years ago in one of the Edinburgh newspapers that they were going to, one of the upgrades that CGI was doing for Edinburgh City Council was replacing all their public space CCTV with high definition cameras so that they could put facial recognition behind it. So and that was dropped in there. And every sort of 6 months or 9 months, I send Edinburgh a freedom of information request saying, have you done it yet? Because you sort of said you were going to do it. So I'm keeping an eye on these authorities. But the next stage for biometrics in schools, sort of bringing it right round full circle with CGI, is the fact that it's all very well issuing 63,000 school kids with iPads, and especially from the school children that we have, 1 to every 5 children under 8. How do you know who's using the iPad? Who's going to be doing the maths homework when you take it home in the evening? Is it going to be your big sister, your best friend? The logical next step for biometrics in schools is for the iPad, and this has happened in San Diego and it got turfed out about 3 years ago, the iPad to start facially scanning every 10, 30 seconds the person that's using the iPad, so they know that the data that's being used at that time is being used by the right human.
By the right human. Imagine that. Imagine how could that not be corrupt? I mean, if we had the investigative journalists of old working for the tabloids, I mean, we used to have women like you in the past working for tabloids, women like you with your brains and your ability to write, not anymore, of course, but they'd be all over this story now with CGI and the and the iPads and them getting the contract. They'd be all over because that stinks of corruption. It stinks to high heaven, that. But that's only the basics, the corruption.
Yeah. I mean, I only found out about this about 10 days ago, so I've not really done much research into it. But the thing is, there's two issues, really. They're all free iPads. They're not free iPads. We've paid for that with the contract, with our public money. And actually, the bill's coming in about £12
million. £12 million?
Yeah, of iPads. But, I mean, apart from any issues of privacy and data processing, there are more and more there's more and more evidence to suggest that the type of blue light that's coming off these devices is really not good for young guys. You know, don't get me started on Wi-Fi and radiation.
Yeah.
And that actually some schools, some more forward-thinking schools in the States and the UK, have, in fact, in Ireland, there's a petition that parents have set up that where a school's done exactly the same thing, issued all the kids with iPads, and parents said, we don't want them to have iPads, we want them to have less screen time. And there's been research in the States to say that when children are reading books, they actually retain more information from a paper book than they do an electronic book. There's something that happens to your brain. You're in a different mode when you're reading electronic devices to when you're actually reading a paper book.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not very forward thinking. But the thing that concerns me is when you get given something for free, you get given a product for free, you then become the product. Now, CGI is not giving away £12 million worth of iPads to 10% of the Scottish school population without some sort of data analytics going on behind that, because they want a return on that.
Of course they do. Of course they do. And the children are the children are subjects, aren't they? They're subjects of that experimentation. And, you know, I would be very interested to watch that story a bit more closely. There's got to be some percentage of the parents will say, this is crazy. You know, they can't all be just going to go along with it.
I hope so. I really hope so.
Yeah, so do I.
I don't know. I mean, I seem to think this is, you know, knowing what I know is quite normal, but I can still say to people, you know, unless they say, what do you do? I say, well, I've campaigned against fingerprinting and biometrics in schools. They're like, what, the fingerprint kids in schools? I've been doing it since 1999. How do you not know about it? And it's because kids and school, we send our children off to school and we think, oh, they'll be safe, it's okay, and so they should be. But actually, there's a whole data mining environment. You know, for example, you could get a text at 8 o'clock in the morning saying, oh, don't forget to bring your swimming costume to school today, or your cricket or whites, whatever, because, and then you get on the school bus and you're clocked on the school bus CCTV, then clocked as you go in CCD cameras in the school. They might use your biometric for registration, then you log on to a computer, and that data trail for the child starts even before they've got to school. When they leave school, that data crunching and the data processing doesn't stop, because whatever that child's done that day then has to be crunched and processed and sent up to local authority or sent to what academy database, and then from there it goes to DfE, then it goes off to a company called RM Education that processes it all and gives it back to the DfE. And that happens 24 hours a day, 52 weeks a year.
52 weeks of the year.
And so I watched The Great Hack on Monday night, I think you did as well, and I watched it and thought, we're all bleating about something.
Yeah.
We chose to do, and yet our children, we're pushing our children into an environment that they have no choice of, and that largely, actually, I would say 99% of the adult population aren't even aware of anyway. So we need to be really looking at this, learning from our mistakes and teaching this to the next generation. Let's not let them blindly wander into something that we did.
Fascinating, that documentary, because it seemed to be, you know, we these days we don't get documentaries maybe that we used to get, where, you know, I know if you undertake to make a documentary, you do so because you've got a strong opinion about something. So your own bias is going to be imprinted on the final product one way or another. But that being said, I thought it was kind of preposterous, and nobody could accuse me of having any sympathy or time for Donald Trump or Steve Bannon or Boris Johnson or Nigel Farage. Not at all. But I seem to be just whining about the fact that something happened that they didn't like. So let's blame it on, you know, our data being manipulated and all the rest of it. And I think one of the salient points of that, and you've just said it yourself, so there's no real need for me to repeat it, one of the salient points that was overlooked was that most of what Cambridge Analytica did was take data that was already there, that was put out there by us and by our friends and family and children. If you leave out the selling of data by Facebook to Cambridge Analytica, which made up only a tiny percentage of it, we're going to have to wake up to, you know, the notion that it's not a good idea to be sitting around putting on Instagram pictures of your children, you know, shouting out loud from a coffee shop where you are, what you're doing. It's not good. You know, we never did that before. This is a completely new thing. Like I often say, anthropologists must be, it's a wet dream for them, you know, to watch people doing this. We need to be more aware of it. Go ahead, Pippa.
I was going to say, it's interesting, because as soon as I watched the film, I sort of said to my partner, and said, well, A, the other side were doing the same thing. B, the government's been at this for years. That's why there's no legislation against it. The government has a... The UK government is the best government in the world for this. They had used to have something called the Nudge Office that operated out of the Cabinet Office. The Nudge part of the Cabinet Office has now been made into a charitable company, and it's called the Behavioural Insights Team. And they have gone from a workforce of seven to, I mean, you can just type in Behavioural Insights Team, UK Nudge, and you'll come up with their website. In fact, I've just got it here. Just let me read, I was just looking at it before we went to air. Just let me read the about us. This is it here. The Behavioural Insights Team exists to improve people's lives and communities. We work in partnership with governments, local authorities, businesses and charities, often using simple changes to tackle major problems. The team has grown from a seven-person unit at the heart of the UK government to a global social purpose company with offices around the world. You can go and read, but they are in education, they are in healthcare, they are in everything. And this is our government. This is our government. So this nudging people and finding what would they say it on the hack? It was the probabilities, the people that were the possibilities or something. They've been nudging us for years. And that's why there's no legislation about it. So it just so happened that, you know, the biggest nudge, you know, that got found out by Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, you know, I don't know why there wasn't another side or an in more in-depth look at the whole.
Of course. Absolutely. And you know, one of the better reviews of the film was in Variety magazine, and the reviewer made that very point. They missed this whole government and intelligence agencies aspect of all of this, you know, going after this company. You made another excellent point. The other side have been doing it as well. If there is such a thing as the other side, it doesn't matter. It hasn't mattered to me for nearly 20 years, you know, left or right. It doesn't mean a thing.
Cambridge Analytica, to be fair, were brilliant at it. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, that just gave, the film gave an insight as to how accurate and what they could do. And I thought it was interesting in Trinidad and Tobago. You'd have to watch the film, but basically Cambridge Analytica managed to swing a vote of population by encouraging a certain part of youth population not to vote.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
It was really interesting. So it's not even getting you to vote, it's getting you not to vote as well.
Yeah, and it's the identity group thing. It's another whole issue. Why people just flock to these things. We see them flocking now to the environmental concern groups. And there are things to be concerned about, the environment. It's dirty and animals and stuff and die-offs and all the rest of it. But the climate change thing is another thing entirely. I think this technology that you've been writing about, watching, searching for, asking for freedom of information requests, all this sort of stuff, is having a profound transformational effect on people. And it's making us less suspicious, less individual, and we just flock. I mean, that was fascinating that they just went along with it. Don't vote, started printing the T-shirts, couldn't wait to join in, and off they went. And wow, Pippa. Because your children are in their teens now, or well, not quite teens, early.
Graduated.
I know. Time flies, eh?
How long I've been at this.
I know, yeah. Well, yeah, and...
And we're home educated as well, so I learned...
You're home educated.
So we, both my children were in primary school, out for high school, went back in for A-levels. They came out with 4 or 5 GCSEs, made no difference whatsoever to their outcome. So if you're stressed as a parent because you've got just had GCSEs, you've got GCSEs coming up, it is fairly meaningless to a child. They if they're good and they want to learn or they want to do whatever, they'll be a success regardless of how many GCSEs they've got. My two are a prime example of that.
Brilliant.
It's been an interesting ride, really, looking at the education system and looking at the wider implications of this sort of technology on the population.
Do us a favour, come back real soon, Pippa, like soon. Don't leave it as long, right? I always say this, pippaking.blogspot.com. That's a good link for biometrics in schools. Check out Pippa on Twitter as well. She's, of course, on Twitter. You'll find her on my homepage. And follow this stuff really closely, because, again, this is one of the more important issues. There's a handful of things. This is huge. And it's going largely unreported. And if it wasn't for the likes of you, Pippa, we wouldn't know about much of this stuff. So thanks for doing it, sincerely. And enjoy the rest of the summer and come back real soon, because there's going to be plenty more to talk about.
Well, I definitely want to pursue this iPad rollout.
Do you? Yeah. Follow that story and give us an update on that real soon.
I will do. Thank you very much for having me on. I do appreciate
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you for your time. I really love having you on. Thanks, Pippa King. The brilliant Pippa King, live on the Richie Allen Show this Thursday afternoon. Biometrics in school. PippaKing.blogspot.com. That's the website if you want to find out more about these issues. I mean, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Company gives out tens of thousands of iPads, allegedly free, to 10% of the Scottish school-going population, school-attending population, CGI. The same company gets the contract to roll out the facial recognition software and cameras. Come on, people. Come on, you know. But not a peep in the UK press, not a peep. Not a peep. I'd be Jesus, not a peep. Why would there be? Nothing to see here. The great Leslie Nielsen once said, rest in peace, nothing to see here. Please disperse. There's nothing going on. If I do that again, I'm going to kill somebody. I've got the microphone close to my face because it needs to be. And I keep banging my bloody glasses off it because I'm an idiot. Anyway, I'll try not to do that again. It's very warm this afternoon. It's been very wet. Are you following that story in Derbyshire? I'm sure you are. I put a link to it on Twitter earlier on about the floods or the potential catastrophe there. I'll bring it up. Will I? In fact, while I'm doing that, I am going to take a quick break for the headlines. We'll get the headlines from FSN. Don't forget, in a couple of minutes, Anna Breese will join the programme. It's been ages since she made her first appearance on this programme. Former ITV, former BBC journalist. Excellent, right? And some of the stuff she's doing around citizen journalism is amazing. And I really want to talk to her about that. And I want you to hear it. Tweet the programme at Richie Allen Show is my Twitter handle. At Richie Allen Show is a Twitter handle. This is the Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Triggerwarning.tv, of course. The TuneIn app and richieallen.co.uk, which is my own website, richieallen.co.uk. Right, we will get the headlines, just the headlines, from FSN. Back with plenty more in about 30 seconds' time.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Holly Hudson. Rwanda has denied claims by the Democratic Republic of Congo that it closed the border between the two countries over Ebola fears. At least 32 people have died in two separate attacks in Yemen. The rebel Houthi movement has claimed responsibility for one of the assaults. And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has described US sanctions on his foreign minister as childish.
Great stuff. It's coming up for 3 minutes past the hour. We'll be calling Anna Breese in a second. Just before we do that, though, here's this.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Right, that's an incredible story. Whaley Bridge Dam collapse. Town evacuated. That's the headline going around the world. Thousands of people evacuated from Whaley Bridge in Derbyshire because of the heavy rain and the floods that have ensued. Part of a reservoir wall has collapsed there, and they're terrified that it would be catastrophic if people were to hang around, so they're evacuating people. The police have told the 6,500 residents to gather at a local school and to take their pets and their medication with them. A severe flood warning, which carries with it a threat to life, was issued for the River Goyt, which is just below the reservoir there. Horrendous stuff, that. Amazing. And good luck to the people there. Let's hope that it doesn't collapse and that everything goes back to normal and they get a chance to make a repair on it, and that it doesn't, as I said, collapse and cause this catastrophe that they're worried it might do. You won't be surprised to learn that... Turn it off, Richie. Jesus wept. You won't be surprised to learn that the climate mongers are dancing all over this story and holding it up there as an example, yet again, that we've destroyed the climate and that this sort of thing is going to be seen much more, many more times in the future. And coastal areas and places villages near big rivers and reservoirs are going to be in danger. They're making hay while the sun shines, even though the sun is obviously not shining. It's torrential rain there, and we've seen it in Yorkshire as well in the last couple of days. I would suggest it's the weather, and it isn't unprecedented. Floods, and for reservoirs to breach and for riverbanks to breach, it's not unprecedented. It has happened through the ages when there has been very heavy rain. But the climate doom mongers, well, they're saying, no, it's climate change, damn it. It's climate change, damn it, and we better believe it. We just better believe it, right? Right, coming up for 6 minutes past the hour, this is Europe's most listened to independent radio show. It's called The Richie Allen Show. I'm Richie Allen. Thanks for listening. Thursday, August 1st, 2019. This is music from Al Jarreau. Back in a minute with Anna Brees. Can't wait. Yeah, the theme from Moonlighting, Al Jarreau on The Richie Allen Show. 8 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Thanks for the tweets. Keep them coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Good to be with you. It really is. I'm delighted that my next guest has agreed to come back on the programme. She was on with us either very early this year or late last year. She's a terrific journalist. Has worked for ITV, as I've mentioned already, and the BBC. She's had a stellar career. She's doing something quite extraordinary now, by the way. And you can find out more about it at the website breesmedia.co.uk. That's B-R-E-E-S, breesmedia.co.uk. And it's around encouraging people with stories to tell, to use the means at their disposal, use their phones, use their tablets, to create their own media and to put it on the internet. It's brilliant. It's not new, but I've never seen anybody do it like her or with the success that she's had to date. So it's breesmedia.co.uk. Let's welcome back to the programme Anna Brees. Anna, welcome back. How are you doing?
Good. It's really good to be back. Nice to be invited back again.
Thanks for coming on. Watching some of the videos that I've seen on your Twitter page of women who were the victims of abuse, who survived it, getting on with their lives, in the absence of any access to talk to commercial media, which is not interested anymore. I know better than anybody. You know better than anybody. Getting them to make their own short films and to tell their own stories. I mean it when I say I've never seen anybody as successful as you at doing that. It's quite extraordinary. And it's grown and grown even since we first spoke. Anna, tell us a little bit more about this. It's an amazing thing.
Well, yeah, no, I'm incredibly touched and flattered that people trust me with their stories. And I think at the end of the day, this is all about those people with courage. And we call them whistleblowers, but it's someone working in an environment where they see injustice. They may have been a victim of abuse, or they may see other people that are a victim of injustice or abuse, and they go, I'm not having this, and I'm going to do something about it. And then they rely on a system, maybe their union, or maybe an ombudsman, or maybe the press, and they believe that that system will protect them. And then they're going up against a brick wall, no one's to know. So I'm giving them another option. They're using their mobile phone devices to get their story out on new media platforms. So I'm teaching them things like how to get the correct lighting, how to use a microphone, how to add subtitles, because 85% of videos now on the newsfeed are watched with sound off, and how to maybe do boosting on Facebook, which is very powerful. And giving them an option to bypass the mainstream media. I don't want to call it the mainstream media because they're not the mainstream media.
It's not media. It's not media, full stop, is it anymore?
It's not. Media. It's media. Media is Latin for message.
For message,
it's a way of communicating something to somebody else.
I should say it isn't journalism. We don't have journalism anymore. You tune into any of the 24-hour news channels any day. Listen to the appalling interviews. Find yourself, and I know you'll be doing it as a journalist, shouting questions that should be immediately asked by the presenter, whoever it is, and nothing. It's dreadful. Propaganda nonsense. What sort of transformation is this having? I know you're not a psychoanalyst or a psychiatrist or a psychologist, Anna, but maybe we all are amateur psychologists. What sort of impact can you see this having on people? Because it must be transformational for them.
It's given them an opportunity to witness and to be heard, and then they're meeting up with other people that may have been through a similar experience to them. And that what I have found, though, there are a lot of whistleblowers who aren't able to be public yet. There are a couple of people that have contacted me following my journalism on BBC Panorama, Saving Syria's Children from 2013, yeah. trying to expose that. And but they, you know, their livelihood comes from the industry that they work in. So there are whistleblowers that don't want to be public, and there are whistleblowers that do. And there's a woman called Jan Cruikshank on Twitter, who I met and trained for 2 days. And since meeting me and connecting with people and doing video, she's getting sort of 500,000 retweet reach a week, and she's getting her story out. But she's so full of courage. And she said, I'd never wanted money. I just wanted to make the world a better place, to make sure this didn't happen again. And it's those people I'm just, you know, she feels like she's got a voice now. She feels like she's got some power.
Well, she's got something very important to say. She's talking about sexual harassment at work and how difficult it is to report that, and how it ends up.
Yes, when you're working, on a very low, you know, you're bottom of the pile at work, and you're on a low wage, and somebody above you does it to you, then exactly, it's very, very difficult to get justice.
Isn't it dreadful it's still going on? And I have no doubt it is, and I'm not trying to score points at anybody here.
Of course it is.
But isn't it dreadful? You know, you see all this Harvey Weinstein stuff, you see hashtag Me Too, and you would imagine that the lousy, sleazy bosses and workers that were taking liberties and doing, you know, uncomfortable things to women and making women feel uncomfortable, you would have thought that would have been a wake-up.
Women and men,
of course, yeah.
Well, there's some hope, Richie. There really is some hope, because these people, things are changing, and they are getting their stories out. And that's why we've seen Harvey Weinstein and Epstein. Have I said that right?
Yeah,
all
Epstein,
these people
yeah.
are starting to be exposed now.
Yeah.
Because people do have a voice, and they have the power to get it out to millions of people. But yeah, I do think things are changing. And the last 3 or 4 years... I've seen massive changes. And you think, you know, this woman, they just thought, well, she's got no power. Jan Cruikshank, she's got no power. She's not going to get her story out to anyone. She's just got a few Facebook friends. We can treat her however we like, you know, without going into the details of the case. But things have changed now. You know, we've got these platforms. And if you know how to use them, and you know how to use video, you are a threat.
You are, of course you are.
And you are, and they can't keep you silent anymore.
It also highlights something very important, Anna. By the way, folks, it's Breese, B-R-E-E-S. Do I say Breese right? It's Anna Breese, isn't it?
Breese.
B-R-E-E-S. Yeah, it's the same in Ireland, you see. Anna Breese, B-R, it's breesemedia.co.uk. And we're talking to a proper journalist here. You know as well as I do, we don't have very good laws in this country to protect whistleblowers still, so we don't. We've been promised them for years that whistleblowers, when they have information that is in the public interest, that they will be able to put it out there without fearing losing their job or what we call retaliation. But we don't have laws to protect people, Anna.
No, and I've heard from a lot of people that have gone to their unions as well and feel let down, and they've put a cap on compensation, or they've refused to investigate fully, or, you know, properly and adequately represent whistleblowers. It's very, very difficult indeed. And what I find with employment tribunals as well, because you've got a whistleblower defence, people have no experience of going to employment tribunal. It's their first experience ever. And usually they settle before it gets to court, so the story doesn't get out into the public domain, and they're forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. So when I did the course, I did a 2-day training course with whistleblowers and also victims of abuse. They were so incredible. They said, we wouldn't do it. We wouldn't sign the NDAs because we want justice. We want things to change for other people. And they didn't want the money.
Good stuff.
I was in a room full of people that totally inspired me, and that's why I'm so delighted that I'm able to run the course again in September. And again, I've got some fantastic whistleblowers, you know, people that were in the prison system and the NHS and the BBC. But I'm just happy to pass on my knowledge of how to bypass
the
mouthpiece of the gatekeepers of truth, the mainstream media, and they can do it with a mobile phone and a bit of knowledge about social media, new media platforms.
Yeah, and you touched on something important earlier on, is the production values. Back in, I think I said this to you the first time we spoke, back in 2013 in London, when I was part of a not very successful TV venture, one of the things we really tried to impress upon people was the production values are vital, they're hugely important, just to get people to watch, you know, because we are subconsciously less likely, whether we know it or not, most of us don't know it, hence subconscious, but we just bypass stuff. It could be a brilliant message.
Yeah, it
could be fantastic. You know this, don't
100%.
You, Anna? Yeah, it's really important.
You know, I completely agree with you, Richie. And as soon as you see someone and you see them on a regular basis, then it builds up this trust, because you see their face, you see their emotion, you see their passion. When you create video, then you build up the trust. It's all about trust. You know, like, and trust. And then I've gained in the last week about 3,000 followers on Twitter, and they message me all the time. They say lovely things, and I message them back, and they tell me their stories of injustice and abuse. But until I meet someone in the flesh, I struggle to trust and believe. But video is that halfway house, isn't it, to actually meeting someone in the flesh?
Yeah, I believe so. It's kind of transformed my approach as well in recent months. But you know, I've always been a radio guy. And didn't really want
your
to be
voice. You hear your voice, so it's the same.
Use your voice, yeah. But I'm well aware of the fact that a lot of younger people who listen to me, they do get more of a kick out of a bit of video. So I give a bit of a video now by way of a crappy a newspaper review thing in the morning, and just to kind of fill that kind of gap, because I understand that I'm a 44-year-old middle-aged grumpy gammon, right? And I don't want to be doing a YouTube stream in the morning because I can't be bothered, but I know that it supports the radio show, and it does. Now, I want to ask you this. It's briefsmedia.co.uk. Let's talk about the media and how it behaves. And you've done a lot of great work in helping to help those who exposed the BBC's conduct around the false claims against the Syrian government. And congratulations on that. It's great stuff. It's vitally important. Let's talk about the reporting around Carr Beach, the man known as Nick, who made allegations.
Just to mention as well, I'm going to be on Russia Today with Robert Stewart, and we're going to be talking to a big audience.
A big audience, and you'll get time on Russia Today. They'll give you some time, which is good. You'll get some bloody time there.
That covers the Syria one. Yeah, that we're doing it on the 7th of August. It's a pre-record for Renegade.
That's a great program.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're asking me about Carr Beach.
Well, it's huge, isn't it? And I spoke to one or two people earlier in the week, and I threw your name in. I know you were away. Thanks for coming on so soon after you've been away for a few days. So let's talk about it then. Let's talk. The man has been sentenced to prison for 18 years for making false statements about murder to the police and naming people, Harvey Proctor and others. Of course, he made allegations about Edward Heath, who's dead, former UK Prime Minister. That's a story I've been covering for nearly a decade, and some of my older contacts have been covering it for 20 years or more. But your approach is fresh and really interesting. What do you think of how the media has covered that and your impressions of Carr Beach and all the rest of it? What do you think?
Absolutely. So he was a liar, a fraudster and a paedophile. Did they know that before they spent £2.5 million on Operation Midland? Did they know? I want to just go through a few things, because before I got prepared for this interview, I've been looking at some of the kind of mainstream media articles, old media articles. Freddie Mayhew in the Press Gazette called it now, following Carr Beach's, what would you call, you got 18 years.
He's sentenced.
Following what's happened in the last few days, he said it's now a fictional Westminster paedophile network. He's just on Carr Beach's, I'm trying to find the right word, help me here, right, Richie?
Based on his testimony,
now the Press Gazette are saying it's a fictional Westminster paedophile network. They're coming out and saying that is fact.
So it doesn't exist then,
Dominic Lawson,
on Carr Beach.
In the Sunday Times over the weekend, again, agreed with this. It's a fictional Westminster paedophile network, and Edward Heath is now innocent, apparently, just following on Carr Beach's testimony. And I just want to mention Dominic Lawson in 2011 wrote an article in the Sunday Times about how he was staying at Epstein's infamous Florida home.
You're kidding.
So why did Sunday Times pick Dominic Lawson to talk about Carr Beach as a comment piece on the Sunday Times?
Do we know why Lawson spent time with Epstein? Was he doing a feature on him? Was he interviewing him?
No, his wife has known him since have a look. All you need to do is look up the Sunday Times article from 2011 from Lawson and Epstein. So he was staying in their Florida home because his wife's known them since the mid 80s or 1988.
Wow. Well, well, well.
So that's you know, everyone right now can go into Google now and put Dominic Lawson and Epstein.
What a coincidence.
Dominic Lawson wrote about Edward Heath on Sunday and said that Dominic Lawson wrote on Sunday, just gone, that Edward Heath is now innocent because of what Carl Beach has done. That was his claim in a comment piece.
It's like washing the hands for the nation. It's all over now, don't worry about it.
Yeah, yes, it's nothing to see here. And is it all fantasy? Has Carl Beach made it all up? And did they pick him on purpose? What I would say is they based it, what it seems to be, all on one man's testimony. What I'd like to raise with people, and I'd like to ask them to go and have a look for themselves, is back in March this year, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse in March interviewed Don Hale, a former newspaper editor, Paul Holmes, a former detective inspector, Andrew Surplice, a former detective inspector, former detective chief inspector Howard Groves, and they all said on oath that they were asked to cover up VIP paedophiles.
Yeah, they did. I remember it well.
Yep. Do you remember? And yeah. Not only, there's Michael Tarriger, James Rees and Anthony Daly also allege that they were witnesses or victims of the meat rack and a Westminster paedophile ring.
Isn't it also amazing?
Has that been in any of the papers over the last few days?
It's been in none of the papers. And do you know what's also amazing?
And Mike Veal, Chief Constable Mike Veal.
Just going to bring it
Wiltshire
up.
Police.
There must be telepathy going on here. I was just going to bring him up. Mike Veal, while he was conducting that inquiry into Edward Heath, Conifer, Operation Conifer, while he was doing it, he was being bombarded by the media, undermining him all the time. He produces a report and he says the allegations against Edward Heath are credible, and if he was alive, he'd be interviewed under caution. Mike Veal then went to Cleveland Police, where he was basically left go or suspended or fired because of some allegation of misconduct. Can you believe it?
A mobile phone and when he was playing golf, I think he damaged his mobile phone, something like that. Well, wow. I was there when he called former Scotland Yard detective John Wedger and they had a conversation off the record. And I just hope and pray that Mike Veal one day goes on the record. Like all whistleblowers, we need them to go on the record and they're scared. I'm aware of certain information in relation to Mike Veal.
I know you can't say it. So you think it's plausible that Mike Veal is being punished for Operation Conifer? Plausible. It's a possibility. We can't say for certain. But we can say it's...
Oh, we need to get him on the record.
We need to get him on the record, yeah.
If the BBC or ITV called him up or Sky News, he might go on the record. But if me, as an independent journalist, former BBC ITV journalist with, you know, no money behind me, try to get him on the record, it might be difficult. He needs a platform that will believe him. And I was looking at the timeline over Jimmy Savile yesterday, and it was very interesting. The BBC knew about Savile for many, 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 many years. And what forced it to come out was ITV. It was actually ITV.
Do tell.
They had the information. They contacted the BBC and they said, we're going to publish this.
So the BBC were sitting on Savile, like the top brass, because this has always been a bone of contention for people. Who knew what? Because I've had, you know, I've never directly worked for the BBC. I did reports for the BBC when I was in Spain and when I was in Ireland. Various stations would ring me up because I was known to do a 3-minute piece or a 4-minute piece on something. And I made a few contacts, but I never worked for them directly. I never took a payment either. My currency was they would give me access to guests in return for my occasional reporting. So the argument has been for years that the top brass didn't really know. They were as surprised by the Savile revelations as everybody else, but this is nonsense.
Well, no, the other thing that I would ask your listeners to look up is somebody called Merian Jones, who lives in Wales. Now, he was a former BBC Newsnight, he was in charge of BBC Newsnight, I believe, and he left to BBC Panorama. And BBC Panorama did a programme on BBC Newsnight called What the BBC Knew. So it was a BBC investigating itself. And he said straight after that, they got rid of him. And they also got rid of a guy called, I believe he's called Tom Giles. He now works for ITV. He's the head of current affairs at ITV. So he was head of BBC Panorama at the time when they did this piece on themselves, and he said that everyone on the right side of the Savile argument, they got rid of them and called them traitors. And that follows alongside the information that I've received in relation to BBC Saving Syria's Children 2013. I've heard from people who are friends of BBC executives, very, very similar story, where they've been bullied. BBC executives have basically been bullied. It's all about loyalty. It's all about keeping quiet.
And yet, because we could talk a bit in a few minutes about Saving Syria's Children. We can. We'll find some time. Depend on how you're fixed for time. I'm on till 7. If you can stay with me for another 15, 20 minutes.
Whistleblowers, you know, BBC whistleblowers. Yeah. Where are they? They need somewhere to go.
But this is the question. That was my question, because I believe you 100% that there would be very uncomfortable staff knowing what the BBC did around the Syria Panorama programme. But yet, yes, who's likely to even publish it? I mean, they couldn't run to the Mail, they couldn't run to the Telegraph, they couldn't run to the Mirror.
Because well, this they is interesting, right? Listen yeah. to this. I don't think George Galloway would run it on his RT Sputnik programme.
No.
But Renegade will. So Russia Today, one programme will, and the other Russia Today programme won't.
And you say you don't think Galloway would run it. Did you approach Galloway?
No, they approached me.
Right. No, yeah, excuse me, but has...
I said... I'm on Renegade talking about BBC Panorama's programme Saving Syria's Children, and they were more scared of the lawyers.
Where are they now? Where are they?
Yeah.
Folks, do bookmark briefsmedia.co.uk. You're listening to Anna Breese, former BBC ITV journalist, doing stellar work with not just whistleblowers around child abuse, but other issues as well, training people to make very polished videos to be uploaded to YouTube and elsewhere, telling their story. This is a remarkable lady, I think, doing a remarkable thing. Savile, then. I've heard from very credible people over the years that Savile, it was an open secret that he was providing children for some very powerful people. Now, you've spent quite a lot of time of late speaking to victims and whistleblowers. Is that the sort of thing that you hear? Not just Jimmy Savile, but some of these other high-profile paedophiles, some of them were procurers of children. Do you hear that sort of stuff, Anna?
It's very difficult, and I've said, and I've been very open about this, we only pass on knowledge from sources that we trust. So yeah, it's only true to me because I've heard it from somebody I believe or trust. So, you know, I've met with people directly and talked to them about their experience of abuse, and a lot of them have been abused in children's homes, especially in London, in Islington, Beach Home, and they weren't high profile. You know, their abusers weren't high profile. I haven't ever met anyone who's been abused by Jimmy Savile. I've met somebody who alleges they were abused by Edward Heath, but it was he explains that it was mild compared to what he received when he was in care, and that Edward Heath just dried him down. They went out sailing, and he gave Edward Heath oral sex, and Edward Heath gave him oral sex. And it's in the book Meat Rat Boy, if anyone wants to read. It's just a very short chapter.
And is he young?
It wasn't a big thing in his life. It wasn't a big, you know, he was anally raped. And I hate to say this, but he was horrifically anally raped from the age of 4, he alleges, at a foster home in Borehamwood by foster carers who are now dead, called Bob and Ivy Woods. So
how did he come to be
the big story? The headline is obviously Edward Heath.
Of course,
it was quite insignificant in relation to everything else that he suffered.
Anna, how did he end up in the company of Edward Heath? And how old was he at the time?
He was at a school. He was like 13 or 14. It was 1962. He was in care, and the deputy head teacher took him to Pinmill in Essex. I feel it's difficult for me to relay all of the details.
No, I understand that. I understand that, yeah. And did you find him, Anna? Can I just ask you this? Like myself, you've interviewed maybe several thousand people, and you get a feel for people. Did you feel that you were speaking to a credible gentleman, that he was telling the truth? Did you feel that?
Yeah,
I know you can't know.
It didn't come up. It didn't actually come up in conversation.
Okay, I'm with you. Yeah. Okay.
He was talking to me about being 4 years old, and his the injustice he feels was
in relation to Lambeth Council. He was angry with Lambeth Council for his care. He was left as a child at the hospital because his mother was a prostitute. He was one of twins, and she just abandoned him at the hospital. And he was really angry with Lambeth Council and how he was put in foster care and basically sold for sex. He didn't talk about Edward Heath. It just came up in conversation after like a couple of days and long, long conversations. It wasn't really a massive thing for him because it was, you know, he had to call him. He said he called him Uncle Teddy, and he was dried down, and he just sort of touched him a bit and played with him a bit. But he remembers the details and how old he was and what school he was at and where it was alleged to have taken place.
Anna Breese is our guest, breesemedia.co.uk. We've been talking about Carr Beach, the independent inquiry into child sex abuse as well. Let's talk about that. Obviously, yesterday, the press reported heavily on revelations about Beechwood Home in Nottingham, which didn't surprise me or my audience, because we've heard from people who were at Beechwood Home. And some of this stuff is hard to believe, Anna, isn't it? Even for, I wouldn't call us hacks or hard-nosed people. We're not hacks or hard-nosed, but we've been around the block a few times, you and I, in terms of we've covered a lot of stuff over the years. But yet to hear that children were returned to foster families where the council knew that those foster families, or at least one member of the foster family, had abused the children, and yet they were sent back there, or other children were sent there. I can't for the life of me figure out how that could happen. How somebody in authority wouldn't say, right, that family there, they never get another child, and we report that family with the information we have on them. But yet, repeat offenders, they kept going back to these families. I just can't understand it. It's like it's like systemic is what I'm thinking, you know?
Well, if you'd said that to me 2 years ago, I'd have agreed with you. But now, because I've spent so much time talking to victims of abuse and people that have been in children's homes, especially in the 60s and 70s, I'm not surprised.
What was going on? I mean, you look back then, you think, I look back, and I know we're somehow conditioned to do this. We're conditioned to kind of look back nostalgically, even to a time when we were not alive. I was born in 1974, but I look at the 60s and 50s nostalgically. It must have been a better time. People must have been kinder. People must have had more time for one another. And yet these unspeakable things were going on. Not only were they going on, but they were tolerated and ignored and enabled.
Well, absolutely agree with you. And at the end of the day, children without, you know, parents, they're vulnerable. No one's speaking for them. It's the same thing with whistleblowers. It's they're powerless. We need to give a voice to the voiceless.
Is it going on today, Anna?
You and I need to do as journalists.
Absolutely right. It's the reason this program exists. That sort of massive scale abuse of youngsters. Is there a suspicion amongst the people you interview? I'll be fair and I won't ask you for your opinion, because you're too fair to be just speculating. So I won't ask you to do that. But the people you meet, do they speculate that it still happens, that children are...
Yeah, that's what they're scared about, yeah.
Institutionally abused.
That's all they care about. They don't want money, they don't want fame. That's all they care about. Whereas a lot of journalists I work with in television, they did just want money and fame.
Yeah.
They did. But the people that I speak to, that's all they care about, is making sure it doesn't happen again.
Making people
aware
of it. That's
all that they're passionate about.
Let's go back to where we came in. While they're doing that, the mainstream beast, in the guise of people like Lawson, you mentioned earlier on, are working hard to create, amongst the population, to create the idea that all of this stuff is false memory syndrome, or it's just complete fantasy, it never happened. What do we do about that? Because it's happening. I mean, today, since Beech was found to be guilty, it's been relentless in the media.
I know, and it's made me so... it's fired me up, and I've got to make sure that I don't let the emotions take over. You know, when you feel really angry, and as a journalist, you've just got to remain calm and focus on the evidence. And it's very, very difficult for me because I think about the injustice, and I think about how this is going to prevent other potential victims of the
you know, the Westminster paedophile ring from coming forward. You know, I'm aware of James Reeves and Anthony Daly and Michael Tarrigan. They haven't spoken to any of them. They haven't looked at the, they weren't there. The independent inquiry into child sexual abuse, there were no journalists there apart from Mark Watts. And I was there. I went. I wasn't getting paid. Mark wasn't getting paid.
Yeah. What did these gentlemen testify to? Remind our listeners, what did they say?
Well, the people that I've mentioned before, Don Hales, a former newspaper editor, Paul Holmes is a former detective inspector, Andrew Surplice is a former detective inspector, former detective chief inspector Howard Groves, told that they were told to ignore the meat rack. They were told to ignore anyone involved who was a VIP, who was seen or photographed with young boys.
And of course, we had Tim Fortescue famously going on the record in 1997, formerly the chief whip of the Conservative Party under Heath, saying that it wasn't unusual for an MP who got into trouble around small boys to get the whips to bail him out, and then the whips would have him for life because he would do whatever they wanted. And Fortescue famously said, that might sound like not a very nice thing. Yeah, of course not. But that's how it went on. And he said it so casually, didn't he, Anna? As if it was just going on and it was just one of those things.
I know, I know. But what are we going to do? I ask you. I think you're one of the rare compassionate journalists, an empathic journalist. And what I say to people is, it was 2009, 2010, and I had a child, and all of the colleagues that I knew and the women in the TV newsroom, they wanted to Sky, you know, I would name them, but I wouldn't want to shame them in any way. And at 6 weeks old, they put their babies into full-time nursery. I wouldn't do that. You know, you're an empathic, compassionate journalist. I get the impression. I'm the same. I'm not doing this for money. I'm not doing this for fame. I'm doing this to make changes.
No, there's no money in it.
To bring about truth and accountability.
You're right. There's no money in it, not in independent.
There's no empathy. There's, with the women in the newsroom, there's no... From on the whole, it lacks empathy. It lacks compassion.
Why is that?
They can put their own children in full-time nursery.
In full-time nursery to pursue a career right now. Let's briefly get into that before we run out of time. Thanks for coming back today. Anna Breese is the guest. Breesemedia.co.uk. Special thing she's doing, I think. I've seen people try it before and it hasn't taken off, but I think Anna's doing an amazing job working with people, getting them to be their own producer, editor and journalist themselves and get their information out there. It's terrific stuff. Is that some sort of... We're getting into really kind of almost like esoteric areas now. But is that some sort of agenda to take the maternal instinct out of women, generally, across society? I wonder about that, you know? You know, I speak to feminists sometimes on this programme and I sometimes bring this up and they laugh at me. And I speak to feminists in my private life. Is there something going on that... the maternal is being driven out of women? I don't know. What do you think?
When I was working in ITV, all of the heads of news were men. The only woman that I knew was a head of news didn't have children. And I think it's changed a bit now that they're more family flexible. But certainly when I was offered a full-time job at the BBC, I turned it down because I had children. And I thought being a mum was more important at that time when they were little. And that was just a decision I made. And I know we've got to be very careful about judging other people.
Yeah.
And the decisions they make are theirs. But, you know, if you don't put your own child first, and we all know, and it's, you know, the evidence suggests that a child needs its mother for the first 3 years of its life. If you're not putting your own child first, you're putting your career first. And I might be criticised for this, and I don't mind if I am. Are you then equipped to deal with kind of these kind of issues, child abuse and whistleblowers and an empathic response to these stories?
That's really interesting. Is there an argument to be made then, and a lot of my listeners would agree with the necessity of mother and child being together for the first few years, is there an argument to be made that the mostly male-dominated media organisations, that they should have, or should in the present, accommodate women who've had children?
They are starting to, and I believe they are starting to accommodate women more. Definitely, they're supposedly that is something that they're taking on board, I think.
So you don't have to lose that
job. You've got the reflex, you know. But there is the thing about television journalists, though, in television journalism, and I hear about people talk about the corrupt TV news or the mainstream media. A lot of it is not about corruption. I don't think it is at all. It's about the news cycle, the daily news cycle, and you have to create content very quickly. So you don't have time. So somebody might call you and say, I'm a whistleblower, and they tell you a long story. You just don't have time. You've got to create a half-hour program that day, or you've got to get a newspaper out. And if you're lucky, what I always ask news organizations when I talk to them, because I've passed stories onto Sunday Times and ITN, is what is your journalism research department like? So a lot of them don't have it.
They don't.
So you've got these fantastic stories and people calling in with these fantastic stories. You just don't have the time to research them. And journalists on the whole, you know, a lot of journalists really do want to, and that they've gone into it for the right reasons. But you have to produce content very quickly. So you have to rely on a very few, you know, a small number of trusted sources, which tends to be people with money, you know, communication departments and PR.
And this is the reason that I've done some funny stuff on this, where if you tune into BBC News 24 at 8 o'clock in the morning and Sky News, they cover the exact same stories in the exact same order. And I present that to my audience sometimes to get them to think about it. Why do they do that?
And brilliant.
You've answered
brilliant.
It. But you've answered
I love it.
Yeah, because they're using the same tiny, tiny group of sources.
Yeah.
And they have no time to do any real in-depth stories. You know, to really do something in depth and to provide analysis of it. It's all bullet points and sensationalism and then move on to something else. It must be a dreadful environment.
Well, I used to write the overnights. So when I worked in TV, I used to, it's called writing the overnights. So you'd write the morning bulletin the night before.
Tell us about that. That must have thrown up some very interesting times, I would imagine.
Well, unless you had an embargo, and there was nothing juicy at all. It was just rubbish.
Just rubbish, yeah.
People only listen to the breakfast news, for the weather and the travel.
Did you get creative, Anna? Did you get creative with it? I can imagine you did get creative with it from time to time. As best you could.
No, I did as I was told. I always did as I was told. I've become far more open-minded and questioning in the last couple of years.
Yeah,
my experience. But you're right. You're 100% right. There is information that they get that they rely and trust on. So I'm quite happy to tell you this, okay? I used to work with somebody called Matt Brindley. He is now the producer of the ITN News at 10. I sent him a recording of a conversation I had with somebody that was mind-blowing, totally mind-blowing, about sexual abuse and VIP paedophiles. And I sent it to him, and no, he didn't listen to it.
Wouldn't
have time.
Wouldn't have listened.
And he just said, this is being dealt with by ICSA and the Islington Gazette. And I don't believe that he was negligent in any way. I believe he did not have the time to listen to it. That's my honest belief. I might be wrong, but you could easily think, oh, he's in some way covering up, or he's some way covering up for the paedophiles or the abusers. I know he did not have time to listen to a 40-minute telephone interview.
Yeah, it's not always the case that people are covering stuff up. You make a very good point there. It's time constraints and a day that never ends. I mean, I have those days producing 5 live radio shows a week packed with content and audio.
Yeah.
On your own is a nightmare. It basically works out at 18 hours a day for me, and I'm not looking for any sympathy whatsoever.
Seriously?
Oh, it's crazy. Absolutely. There's no editor, no producer.
Have you heard of the Canary?
The Canary.
The Canary?
Yes, yes, I've read some of the Canary
stuff. They contacted me. So, you know the anti-Semitism programme that BBC Panorama published last week?
Yeah, and I was going to bring that up. I mean, that was outrageous.
Well, they said, they called me and they went, we really want you to comment on this. We're going to do an article in it. And I went, that's great. They said, our deadline is 5 o'clock. It won't be a story tomorrow. And I went, what? But I've got all of this information about BBC Panorama and Saving Serious Children. I've done loads of investigation into BBC Panorama. And they went, no, it won't be a story tomorrow.
It won't be a story tomorrow.
Anti-Semitism and BBC Panorama and Jeremy Corbyn's only a story today? What?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, no, because Panorama used some people that were caught in a Al Jazeera expose called The Lobby. And they put those people on the air. And they didn't challenge any of the information that they were being given. You know, people saying we were abused, we were called, these awful names. It was a dreadful piece of claptrap. No matter which side of it you're on, you'd have to be honest and say it was rubbish. So for the Canary to say to you, it won't be news tomorrow, well, I don't know who the hell is working at the Canary, but that's just rubbish. Of course
they're
it's going
scared.
To be...
It was like, well, we're not sure it will be news. It's current now. And we've got to... It's the daily news cycle. And the daily news cycle, I think, comes from that four-channel era where we're all taking in news from four or five channels on TV or the newspaper, which comes out once a day. But I want people to see news in a different way and to ingest it in a different way. It's not just the day-to-day. And I really encourage people to do their own research. You know, this whole Carl Beach scenario, ICSA, back in March, they've got all of the Westminster hearings. You know, don't take my word for it. Go and look for yourself.
Read
you know,
the transcripts.
I've mentioned one, two, three, four detective inspectors, former detective inspectors or former detective chief inspectors talking about how they were asked or told to cover up the Westminster paedophile ring. So go and do your own research. Don't listen to me.
The transcripts are there for anybody who wants to read them, Anna. You're absolutely
right. The videos
right.
are there. Them the videos actually talking there. And they swear on oath as well.
Swearing on oath. Swearing on oath that we were told to drop it. I remember hearing that for the first time a couple of years ago. I remember hearing it. Speaking to people, speaking to former policemen, and we know one or two people, you and I, we share one or two contacts, and other people I've spoken to that I find to be very credible that used to be in the police, I've heard from one or two people that can't go public. They've said to me, absolutely, Richie, we got to a certain stage and it was closed down. And anybody who's listened or read Maggie Oliver's book about the Rochdale grooming gang, you know, it's hard to read when you're reading it. They go to their superior officers with a little package with a lovely bow on top, with irrefutable evidence, with names, with everything. And they're told, just stop now, quit it now, quit it. It's all there, you know, if people want
well,
to be...
Well, what we need to do, Richie, is give those senior police officers who probably want to come forward, they probably got kids, and, you know, not everyone's a psychopath, but they've not had a place to go.
That's
they've
right.
not had a welcoming place to go that will believe and trust them.
But you know why they won't they come still... on this programme? I'll tell you why they won't come on with me. And there's one particular gentleman I've been in touch with for about 4 years now. He's got a child... a young girl who's still in high school. She's coming to the end of it, or what we'd call secondary school. And he's got a son who's trying to get work in the city, and he's terrified of retaliation. It's not about his own financial situation, because he's retired. He went into the private sector, made some money. He retired young, but he's terrified of retaliation. He believes...
Well, he's more in danger now.
This
he's
is it, you see.
More in danger now by
this
keeping
is it.
Quiet.
Yeah. Well, maybe you
as
could
soon
make
as
that
I
argument.
I got the information, I went public because I felt that I was at risk.
Yeah. And these are arguments I've made. And with some people, it's like, no. You know, I had a lady came to me last week, very credible woman. She has a story about forced adoption. But until her own child turns 18, she won't tell me. For fear that the social services will start knocking on the door. She said, Richie, in 18 months' time, I'll come and give you the story of your life. And gave me the outline of it. Incredible. But the fear of retaliation, because we don't have the law. The law isn't fit for purpose in this country to protect people who've got stories to tell.
No. And you have to respect them and people that are scared and for whatever reason. I was just talking to a guy literally 10 minutes before I spoke to you, very similar situation. And you have to respect that.
You do, and you and I are...
One day when they're... I don't know, they're scared. They're scared. People are scared.
Of course they are. And people like you and I, we've got an appetite for it. You want to get the story out there. Not for your own benefit or your own gain, but you want to get it out there.
Well, what drives you? My father drives me. What drives you to do this?
Just a sense of kind of embarrassment that when I spent several years producing radio programmes commercially in Ireland for a big and a successful station... Just kind of embarrassment at what we were doing. Like, we were suppressing stuff. Subconsciously, as well as consciously. You know, we took the wires, we rewrote the wires into news stories. We spoke to politicians. And we prevented, not all the time, you know, but a lot of the time we were basically just serving the establishment. We were basically parroting the establishment line. Even though my presenter, who was brilliant, and he was compassionate, and he was decent, and he was lovely, and I was a good producer. We didn't mean to do that, but we did. And that's what kind of led to a change in me. and September the 11th.
That's incredible.
And, stuff.
And you've made a good point too, in that there are so many journalists that are like us.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to get them on side, really, haven't we? Attacking them is probably not the best way of dealing with this situation.
No, and I try not to. You know, some of the presenters now, I give the presenters a hard time. When I do a monologue, I play some of their clips and I laugh at them. That's okay. But no, the journalists and the writers and the papers, no, I don't bully them or, you know, or go on about them all the time, because I think, yeah, look.
I was naive.
They're like
me. I look back at who I was just naive.
We didn't know any better.
I was just very naive.
Anna, I could spend all day speaking with you and I wouldn't dream of patronising you. It's brilliant to speak with you. Go to briefsmedia.co.uk, folks. Check out Anna Breese on Twitter as well. Come back again real soon, and it's great work you're doing with whistleblowers. And
great work you're doing.
Not at all. All I do is give a platform to people to talk. You're actually engaging with people and doing something that's tangibly terrific, and I'm proud to be speaking to people like you. That's what this program is for. So
same here.
Come back again soon, Anna. Thanks. Enjoy the rest of the summer. Let's get together again in the autumn and have another natter about these issues. I'm delighted to know you. Thanks for coming
and
on.
And remember, things are changing. I can feel it every single week. Things are changing. And when I talk to you again, we'll have a lot of good news stories, I think.
I think so too. Anna, thanks a lot. Enjoy the rest of the evening and thanks for your time today. Really appreciate
it. Take care.
That was Anna Breese, briefsmedia.co.uk. And as I said, Anna is on Twitter. There's only one Anna Breese, B-R-E-E-S. The time is 7 minutes to the top of the hour. Fascinating stuff. Look, you'd have to be a complete thickwad, a dumbo, to not see what's happening with Card Beach. The man known as Nick. There's no doubt that some of the things that Carl Beach said are true and happened. I think there's also little doubt that there was a kind of a scattergun approach with him to naming people. Maybe that he was maybe induced to name, maybe. Maybe he was coerced into naming certain people. And the conviction that he has of downloading the images online, yeah, it's not nice, is it? You know, you can't condone that or seek to justify it. People say to me and have said to me that those who are sexually abused, some of them go on to do things like that. I don't know. But it's patently obvious to me that what the media has done, and all I'm doing here is paraphrasing Anna, and she put it very, very succinctly, better than I ever could, she put it. They're using the guy now to say, well, that's it now, you know, clap your hands together. Nothing to see here at all. This VIP paedophile ring is a nonsense. It just is nonsense. It's a fantasy. And we should be much more grown up about these things. And we shouldn't give any credence to any of this stuff at all. Job done. Let's move on. That's what's happening, I believe. Because it's been relentless. Since the man was found guilty, which is what? 2 weeks ago now? 10 days ago? He was found guilty and then there was a 4 or 5 day wait to the sentencing. It's been relentless. You know, it's program, it's conditioning. You must believe that this is untrue. That this is all a fantasy, because we were telling you every day of the week. Now we have judges saying that the police who investigated these allegations should themselves face criminal charges for their part in it. Mad stuff. That's it for the programme today. Now, I did tell you earlier in the week that tomorrow I would present a live radio programme with Dean Henderson, the legendary Dean Henderson of Henderson lefthook.wordpress.com. The book that Dean has given me, I've not managed to read more than a couple of pages of it. And I'm going to read it over the bank holiday weekend. So I won't be with Dean tomorrow afternoon, sadly. But he's going to come on the programme with me next Tuesday. In the meantime, I'll be back with you tomorrow at 9:30 for the review of Friday, the Friday UK morning newspapers. We'll do that tomorrow on YouTube as usual. So until then, all I can say is a massive thank you to Anna Breese, whom you've just heard, and Pippa King, the terrific Pippa King. Pippa King, I've not got it handy, have I? Aren't I terrible? Let me do that. Let me finish off on a high. Let me finish off on a high and get Pippa's. It's pippaking pippaking.blogspot.com. That's pippaking.blogspot.com. That's where you'll find biometrics in schools. And it's briefsmedia.co.uk. Thanks to you for listening. See you tomorrow at 9:30. Until then, look after yourselves and one another. Have a brilliant rest of your Thursday evening. RichieAllen.co.uk is my website. And it's youtube.com/RichieAllen Show for the newspaper review tomorrow. Closing out with Aslan. Bye now.